From the Paley Center for Media in New York, this is Max Media. Here's Max Robbins.
Hi, everybody. We're here today with Alan Rusbridger. He's the editor of The Guardian. For those of you not familiar with it, it's a wonderful, wonderful newspaper and has an incredible online presence. Although I imagine most of you who are listening to this do know The Guardian. They've been extremely successful in increasing their reach. The digital age has been extremely good to them. And a big reason is Alan and the work he's done. I wanted to start out, Alan, and first thank you for coming, but you've lately been making a lot of noise about the future of the journalism business. And you gave a lecture, the very prestigious Cudliff Lecture, and you've been asking a simple yet profound question. Does journalism exist in this new world? I really want to know what you mean by that, why you're asking that question, and maybe just expand a little.
Well, I think we have to strip back what we're doing right back to the essentials, and I think those are the questions that are being asked of us. So we live in a world now in which anybody can be a publisher, and lots of people are publishing really good material. I think this tired old debate about whether old media is better than new media is a thing of the past. If we're honest as journalists, there are people producing really good content. Now, whether you want to call it journalism or not is either a primary question or a secondary question. But let's have the humility to acknowledge that it's there. And then I think you have to either see that as a great opportunity, you're going to work with it, or you see it as a terrible threat and you're going to put barriers around it. But these are very profound questions. And with an economic recession and the trouble that newspapers are in, they're becoming sharper.
Well, you've really keyed in on this, and with The Guardian, have a very pronounced point of view, it seems. You've talked about your approach to newspapers, describing, well, really contrasting ideas between the ideas of closed and open. That's the big debate in the industry. You seem to be a guy who says, hey, let it be free.
Well, let's start from the point of view of saying let it be open and let it be collaborative, because I think that is where journalism is going to go. It's certainly where all other information is going. So if you look at politics, activism, culture, science, academia, whatever it is, they're all becoming publishers. It's all going to be open and accessible. So if that's the way that information is going to go, it's a very profound thing to say we want to be apart from that. We want to cut ourselves off from that. To the contrary, I think the best journalism is being now created by people who see that and say, actually, by linking to it, aggregating it, curating it, being part of that, you're making your content something that is going to be completely woven into the way people talk to each other. So it's a very profound fork in the road that's facing us.
So many of your brethren of the journalism tribe kind of feel threatened by this, by that people are encroaching on their turf. But it seems you've taken a very different road and see the fact that this doesn't in any way usurp your authority or the power of your brand, if you will, in a sense that this is a real opportunity to enhance it. And I thought maybe you could talk about that.
Well, I think so. I mean, the most unthreatening way I think of it is to talk about a theater critic. Now, on The Guardian, we've got a great theater critic who's been writing for us since the 1960s. He's written the definitive book on theater since the war. He's called Michael Billington. Now, you'd have to be crazy to say we're going to get rid of Michael Billington and replace this with a lot of Twitterers. But if you ask the question, there's Michael in the front row of a play that may run for 6 months at the National Theatre. Is he the only person who is worth listening to in that audience that night? Now, most journalists will say, no, I'll grant you that.
Michael probably feels he is.
Even Michael would feel that. So at that point, you have agreed with what I call mutualization. So there's a mutual interest in allowing anybody in that audience. Then you get down to the secondary issues of how you edit that and how you curate it, how you sort the good stuff from the bad stuff. But at the end of it, you've got something that is richer, more diverse. They can write about that show at any point during the 6 months that it's on. Michael can come back and say, actually, reading your comments, you've seen things in this play that I haven't seen, and I'm going to go back and see it, or I revise my opinion. You get something that is more to and fro, more iterative, more involving, more participative. you're probably going to find three or four theatre critics who are nearly as good as Michael Billington. And if you don't feel threatened by that, but embrace them. So that's the positive way of looking at it. The negative way of looking at it is if you try and hold that back and say, we just want Michael Billington, if you want a blog, go and do that somewhere else. You have to be completely aware that people will do that somewhere else, and they'll do it pretty well. And if you then say, well, actually, we're going to force you to pay for Michael Billington, all that free content is going to be out there. And the probability is, I think, that in the end, the free model will win over the paid model. So it's both an opportunity and a threat.
The you from the Cudlip lecture quote here, I'd like to read to you from that lecture. We feel as if we are edging towards a new world in which we bring important things to the table. Editing, reporting, areas of expertise, access, a title or brand that people trust, ethical, professional standards, and an extremely large community of readers. The members of that community could not hope to aspire to anything like that audience or reach on their own. They bring us a rich diversity, specialist expertise, and on-the-ground reporting that we couldn't possibly hope to achieve without including them in what we do. I think that capsulizes a lot of what you're saying here. And it's why, though, are so many people in the fraternity of journalists not joining you in your embrace and feel threatened by it?
They feel understandably anxious. They've all got mortgages and families, and they're worried about how this is going to be paid for. And I completely understand that. And I think everybody's going to come to the business model that suits them. All I'm saying is that I think the opportunity is great. I think it's historic. We're at a moment where the journalistic potential has never been richer. And if you rush to what seem like rational business decisions now, you could be impairing the things that will create compelling journalism. So, and I know this is easy to say as an editor rather than as a business manager, but I think history has always been about producing a compelling editorial proposition and then building the business model around it, rather than just saying, we created this content and you have to pay for it, which I think is going to be limiting in terms of the editorial possibilities.
With that in mind, I mean, you're in a kind of a unique situation. You don't have to worry about quarterly earnings as much as a publicly held company. A trust controls The Guardian. And you're losing a lot of money. Do you see your investment from and I'm sure you have first-rate journalists working for you, with you. Do you see us getting to that point of inflection soon where this kind of digital investment and digital embrace pays off, if you will?
Well, about 10 years ago, I did something which has become known as the Rusbridger Cross for some reason, because it's not a cross. And it's a long line that shows decline in print, and it's another line that shows the growth in digital. And my whole point was that those two lines are not going to cross, and there's going to be a bubble in between those two lines, and that's where we are at the moment. We're in that bubble. And you say we're in a unique position. I mean, actually, all The Guardian Trust does is to enable us to play against people like Rupert Murdoch. So Rupert Murdoch, or in Britain, there's a Russian oligarch just bought the Independent. So they're not in it for profit. The Times and the Sunday Times in London lost £87 million last year.
A lot of
the
money.
The Guardian lost about 35. So this is not a game at the moment for profit. We're in this period when we're being buffeted by the recession. The technologies are robbing us of audience and advertising in print. So it's not a sensible game. So it's lovely being owned by a trust, and the trust, as you say, means we haven't got quarter by quarter pressure to come up with an instant business model. So it's possible that just gives us a bit more freedom to try and think a bit more long term about what's important journalistically.
Do you think, though, that you'll be able to turn the corner in the foreseeable future? Will you come back and visit us here in a couple of years when you can tell me, Max, it all worked, the investment paid off?
It's unknowable. It really is. I think Rupert Murdoch would say what he's doing is a hunch. The New York Times is trying a hunch. We don't know. The iPad came along last week. Ever since I went to Aspen, Colorado 15 years ago and saw a block of wood that had been made by Knight Ridder, who had imagined the iPad, I've always thought that the questions about the form in which people will read The Guardian are completely beyond me. There's no point in wasting any time thinking about it. All I can do is to make The Guardian journalism as good as it is, as good as it can be, in many forms. Then it'll be up to the readers how they want to access that.
But you know, you mentioned the iPad. Is this the killer device? Is this the thing that, I know you've had a little bit of a chance to play with it. Is this the thing that's going to be like the original iPod that makes this a dominant way of reading, of consuming information, and can this be something that really helps drive the business model you're trying to get to?
Well, I think it's a very compelling device. I played with it for about a week, and it was about 3 days before I really saw the point of it. I think the point of it may be a rather retrograde one, i.e., it took 400 years for publishers to settle on the size of a book. and I think the size of the book wasn't accidental. It's a good size to carry and to read text on. And I think it's no accident that Apple have ended up with something around the same size. So I think it's a brilliant thing. It's a brilliant thing for reading web pages. It's a brilliant thing for reading books. I don't know if it helps with the business model. But I think journalistically, it's brilliant. That the big question for me is whether it's going to be a browser experience or an app experience. Almost disappointingly, because there's money in apps, the browser experience is so good that it's worryingly good, which is why I hesitate to say it's going to be the magic wand for business models. But when Knight Ridder were playing around with their block of wood 16 years ago, they were imagining a time where you would turn off the printing presses. And of course, if you turn off the printing presses, which is no longer unthinkable, at that point you save a very great deal of cost in distribution, paper, ink, and wholesale and retail. And so the economics of what we're doing is going to be in flux for decades now, I think.
Really looking at decades for this, you think that that there won't be the kind of adaptation where you can take these big cost centers out and be able to keep this wonderful news product you have?
Well, it might be. We don't know about the payment system for how people would pay and whether it's going to be an easy one-click model. It'll be really interesting to see what happens to the New York Times and to the Times in London. So we're all learning from each other. And the last thing I want to do is to lecture anybody else about their models. But I think we will all learn from each other. But the point I keep coming back to is, let's not kill this period of incredibly rich journalistic experiment. It feels like the clouds, briefly opened, and you've got this period which Caxton and Gutenberg and these sort of early pioneers of the democratization of media would have understood and been astonished by. And I just get anxious about a stampede of people who are now saying, well, that didn't work. Let's close it down.
Let's put up the wall.
Let's put up the shutters. It didn't work. And that just seems to me crazy.
The competitive part of you, though, seems from some of the things you've written and said, is that you like nothing better than to see the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Times of London put all that journalism behind the wall. Don't you think that would drive your traffic through the roof and with that revenues?
Everything is a threat and an opportunity. At the moment, we've got 37 million uniques a month. That places us, I think, just behind the New York Times in terms of English language newspaper publishing. And we've managed to sell 120,000 iPhone apps. We've in the last 9 days, we've sold 50,000 iPad. We've given away 50,000 iPad apps. Sorry.
Are you regretting that now that you didn't?
Well, it was a toe in the water when we were. I think we were the first newspaper to charge for an iPhone app, actually, they've been amazingly popular at $3.99. But we had no idea what to charge or whether you can move that to a subscription model. So there are opportunities here. I think, again, to go back to editorial, the editorial opportunities are changing the nature of reporting. So the very story-based idea of how you do reporting, I think, is becoming much more flexible. So the smartest reporters are saying, are perhaps doing blogs rather than stories. They're not trying to report everything themselves. They're saying they get up in the morning, they cover the health beat, they say there's this piece in the Times here, there's this piece in the Post, there's this piece in the New England Journal of Medicine. They can point out, this is the linked world of information that I was talking about. So they don't have to spend their time, everybody rewriting the same version, and they can say, I can tell these stories very quickly by linking in order to spend my time more efficiently on the piece I really want to write today.
Gotcha.
And that seems to me the natural way that information is being used by digital natives. And again, I think that's really interesting.
Do you see a shift in terms of resistance among reporters to embrace this, to embrace how you see this philosophically? I mean, we've heard that you really require your reporters, they have to be using Facebook, they have to have followers on Twitter. I mean, they have to be using these tools. That's part of working at The Guardian.
Dramatically different patterns within Britain, within one newspaper, within Europe. If you go to Germany and you say, we want all our reporters to tweet, you get very serious faces, and the reporters say, do you, as editor-in-chief, edit every tweet? And you say, how could I do that? And they say, well, our editors would never allow that. They would never let content out of the building that hadn't been edited. Well, if you're in that mindset, I think you're in trouble. I try and get everybody to tweet. It's a brilliant way of using your audience, of saying, help me write this story. You've got some of this information. And when you've written the story, you can then market it. You can send it out to people and saying, come and look at this story. And that's moving you into a world in which you're involving the readers before you write stories. You're involving them in writing it. They can come and comment. They feel involved. They feel engaged. And the holy grail that advertisers are looking for at the moment is involved, engaged readers. I think you get to that point through participation rather than by slamming up a paywall and saying, just pay me, we're not interested in what you say.
Within the Guardian culture, I mean, your organization and really under your leadership has been traditionally ahead of the curve. I mean, in terms of newspapers and I think a Web 1.0, you really led in going digital and probably has a lot to do why you have digitally you've expanded your reach. I mean, it's really pretty incredible that you literally have here stateside, you have more readers online than the Los Angeles Times.
We've got an audience of about 12 million in America, and our total marketing spend for that was $34,000. We went on a big marketing drive. So people are finding us, and again, you know, I think there are opportunities. I think some of the American press has become quite parochial, has withdrawn from the world. And so I think people come to The Guardian because they see an internationalist perspective. We're liberal. I know that's a dirty word in some parts of America, and people like the New York Times would rather die than be thought of as liberal. But people who want a progressive viewpoint or alternative viewpoint, a second opinion, will come to The Guardian. So I think people come to us. We're never going to be the main source of news in America. But I think for an alternative point of view, people find things that the American media aren't giving them.
I'm certainly in this digital age, Alan, we know drop Lady Gaga's name into a story, you're going to get traffic, whoever is the scandal du jour, Tiger Woods or whoever. But what I'm really curious is around what subjects, what are those things where you see audience really building an interest and involvement that's helping you cover the story?
Well, I think there was a period where people were dazzled by SEO, search engine optimization, and if you could get Lady Gaga into a story about health or politics, then you would get the traffic, but it was fairly meaningless traffic. I mean, actually, the subjects that have really grown for us are subjects, I mean, the environment is up something like 140% year on year, politics, culture, serious comment sites. Overall, we're up 40% year on year. I mean, this is not a story of media decline. This is a story of increasing audiences. And environment's an interesting issue because we took a view when we started our environment site that this was one of the most important subjects any news organization could cover. And secondly, we couldn't possibly do justice alone. So we built an environment network in addition to our reporting. So we have six reporters who cover the environment. But we also said there are at least 10 or 20 really expert sites out there who are going to give us better content than we could create ourselves. So instead of competing with them, we'll put them on our site. They get access to this audience of 37 million. So they get the traffic. We'll split the revenues. And we become a platform as well as a publisher. That seems to me an act of collaboration where everyone gains. We get better, richer, more expert comment. And they get access to a much larger audience. I think these are the models that we have to explore.
I'm kind of interested about your own media consumption, because obviously that probably has something to do with how where this is you're leading your organization editorially. What are some of the sites you have bookmarked? Where are you going several times a day that you can tell us about?
The BBC is a wonderful organization. I mean, the BBC is actually the one business model that it's not a business model, but it's the one model that sustains brilliant, serious journalism. So I would say to anybody, they're a pest to compete against because they're so good. I think the New York Times is one of the world's great news organizations, and I couldn't get through life without looking at that a couple of times a day. I think places like Slate are both in what they do in text and what they do in audio are great. And I look at some of the European papers in ways that I could never have done 5 or 6 years ago. So it's pretty eclectic.
What about on your DVR? Do you have a DVR?
I don't even know. What's a DVR?
A DVR, it's like TiVo.
TiVo, all right.
Yeah. What do you have on your TiVo? What are you watching?
I watch Current Affairs and a bit of HBO and but I'm very sad. I spend most of my life editing, so I don't get
You don't have much time to just kick back.
No.
Well, but you know you have to commute. What's on your iPod?
My iPod has a lot of music, and I'm a big fan of TED Talks. I think that's maybe illustrative of the way things are going, that if you've got 20 minutes to kill in a waiting room or an airport or on a train, and you just think, actually, I'd really like to know more about the debate about climate change or about particle physics or transportation problems, that I think TED is a great way of finding condensed 20-minute lectures by world experts that are compelling.
Do you think that's part of it too, what you do editorially? You mentioned TED Talks. I know. Do you think that part of your editorial job is to look for other forums to expand kind of the Guardian's reach in that kind of public forum, summits, conferences, bringing together extremely smart people on the issues of the day?
Well, I think, again, this is sort of half editorial, half business model. But I think if what we're doing is building communities, and that's how I think of it. So I think we can't ever aspire to do everything for everybody. So there are some things that I think we can report from a different perspective or where our input would be different. So I think of things like the media. I think of the Guardian's take on economics and world development would be different from football, international football rather than mainstream football, technology, politics, the environment. So there are some deep verticals of subjects that we're doing. I think the law could be one where you can get communities around the content. You can almost measure them now through Twitter. We have 1.5 million people following our technology coverage on technology. Well, that's a vast community.
It really is.
On science, we've got 21,000, much smaller, but very, I would guess, distinct, knowledgeable people.
A very quality audience.
Yeah, and I think you then think about what else you can do with these communities once you learn who they are and what you can, and that might be a business that involves conferences or publishing, maybe something that's not newspapers, that you build around a newspaper in order to serve those communities.
You know, you spent a lot of years as a reporter, as a journalist, and you're telling me you don't have a lot of time to really kick back and enjoy the cop show or or whatever. But do you miss it? Do you miss really being out there and all? I know you do quite a bit of writing, but do you miss?
Yeah. I mean, for me, the greatest thrill at the moment is the stories where we're doing this kind of stuff around really important journalism. So a couple of examples. We did a big series on tax avoidance, which almost literally a subject where they knew more than we do. That would be not exaggerating at all, because we knew almost nothing about it. So
it's
a highly complex subject. So you set a reporter on it who becomes an instant expert. And then you say, look, out there will be people who understand this stuff much better than we do. You build in the interactive tools, hey presto, we got an amazing response to that, with people sending us documents, filling us in on our gaps in knowledge. MPs' expenses, 400,000 documents released in one day. No newsroom could cope with that. So we built a widget. We said, the readers, you're going to have to help us here. 23,000 readers went through those 400,000 documents and told us what we should be looking at, what we shouldn't. The death of Ian Tomlinson, a guy who died in the G20 protests last year. A reporter didn't believe the police verdict, and he appealed for eyewitnesses. He said, look, I've worked out where this man died and at what time. Look through your digital cameras and see what evidence you've got. And lo and behold, a hedge fund manager in New York found he had captured the moment in which this guy had been assaulted from behind by a police officer. And that led, you know, so this is major investigative journalism in which we're saying, we can't do this alone. We need your help. And we know that you have either got the expertise or you have got the material. And these are, I think, the exciting things that make the job a pleasure still, because we're reinventing how journalism is done.
There really is. It's the ability, it seems, that if you want that kind of vivid, rewarding future, you got to embrace the crowd, embrace your audience.
Let me give you one more example.
Okay.
Big investigation into a company called Trafigura. They dumped a lot of toxic sludge in Africa. 30,000 Africans started one of the biggest class actions. We were injuncted. We couldn't reveal the internal report. We were even gagged from reporting Parliament. So I wrote a story in the paper saying that, and I tweeted saying, we can't tell you this question in Parliament. By the morning, Trafigura was the most discussed subject in Europe on Twitter, and everyone just went in search of the information, and they ferreted it out. They got there in a form that made the super injunction look ridiculous. And it was a case of strangers getting together and saying, we'll crack this story and we'll crack the legal flummery around it in order to tell people. I mean, these are really exciting, revolutionary things that we can do nowadays. And that's why I keep saying, let's keep experimenting and seeing what we can do with this rather than retreating.
It sounds completely exhilarating, and no wonder you find what you do so compelling, and we find so compelling the newspaper you produce, whether we're reading it paper or whether we're reading it on the web. Alan, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and joining us.
You've been listening to Max Media, a production of the Paley Center for Media in New York City. We're on the web at paleycenter.org. That's P-A-L-E-Y center.org. And you can reach us by email at maxmedia@paleycenter.org.